Even the Cold War was not able to stop this work from happening.
The valuable history of walrus research between Russia and the United States. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, August 1st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Alaska Airlines announces plans for expansion in Anchorage.
We see that there's a future for business in the state of Alaska, and there's definitely a future for Alaska Airlines in Alaska.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
It's summer and time to get out on the water, whether you're commercial fishing, heading to a weekend cabin, or tossing in a line to catch tonight's dinner. Having a boat means regular maintenance projects, fueling, and cleaning. Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to minimize waste and pollution during these activities. Ask your harbor master for waste disposal information. Find more at alaskacleanharbors.org. This message sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
The National Park Service is partially reopening the road into Denali National Park, where a large mudslide crossed it near Mile 67 west of the Eielson Visitor Center on Saturday. The agency reports crews working around the clock over the weekend were able to clear a lane through the 100-foot-long slide of mud and debris. Visitors who had been stranded west of the slide were able to get out Sunday, and traffic was also allowed through again at 8 this morning. Another opening was scheduled for 6 tonight. The Denali mudslide is the result of heavy rain. The park reports measuring nearly 8 inches of rain at Eielson last week. National Weather Service meteorologist Benjamin Bardis says July precipitation there was extreme.
From July 1st through the 30th, not including the 31st, the Eielson Visitor Center saw 16 inches of rain, which is incredible.
Weekend rain also bumped up last month's precipitation tally in Fairbanks, where Barta says July ranked as the fourth wettest on record with 4.97 inches of rain.
And then for the two-month span of June and July this summer, that was actually the second wettest on record with 8.26 inches.
Barta says as much as 4 inches of rain fell on hills north of Fairbanks over the weekend, raising already high rivers, which are flooding low-lying areas, including along the Chena and Tanana rivers.
The Steamboat subdivision has been getting some water across roadways out towards North Pole there, and then around Rosie Creek as well, we've seen water come over roadways. And those are the two big impact areas so far around Fairbanks. And then further up the Chena, we're talking the upper Chena, like Granite Tours, that area that Chena has seen some high water. So like low-lying boat launch areas and trailheads in that area would be inundated with water as well close to the river.
A flood advisory remains in effect for the Fairbanks area until Wednesday afternoon. Bardis says some drying is forecast.
The low-pressure system that brought us all these rain showers and a lot of steady rain actually over the past few days has pushed through us, and we'll see some gradual clearing.
Bardis cautions there's a chance for more rain later in the week. What brought the Soviet Union and the United States together during the Cold War? Walrus. Now, a new federal database created with more than a century of information shows where those animals haul out on both sides of the border. And that's especially important as sea ice disappears and the animals spend more time on land. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins reports.
There's just so many animals there. It really reverberates in your chest, especially when you're laying on the sand.
That's Tony Fishbach, a wildlife biologist with the U.S. Geological Survey. He's describing listening to more than 10,000 walruses on the beach in Point Lay. When he's in the field, Fishbach dresses up in an outfit that looks like beach debris to sneak up on the animals to radio tag them. He says not too long ago, this spot looked different.
Well, prior to 2007, we've never had large numbers of walruses on the northwestern coast of Alaska.
That's when the sea ice disappeared off the continental shelf of the Chukchi Sea. In the summer, female walruses and their babies spend time offshore hauling out. They float on sea ice to a walrus version of the grocery store, an area full of nutrient-dense food like clams. But with the melt, they've had no choice but to come onshore.
When they're onshore, if they get moving, they can develop into a panic and there can be trampling injuries and deaths.
Fishbach says he's encountered over 100 walruses who died like this, mostly babies. But this isn't the only time in history biologists have been concerned about the Pacific walrus. In the 1960s, Fishbach says commercial over-harvesting, not melting sea ice, was seen as a potential danger. And to get an idea about walrus population, the United States had to team up with an unlikely ally.
Even the Cold War was not able to stop this work from happening.
Anatoly Kochnev is the co-author with Fishbach on the Hallout database, which holds 160 years worth of information. It's a historical treasure trove, from old ship logs to joint aerial surveys that happened before the fall of the Soviet Union. Basically, our countries go way back on working together on walrus.
Walruses are not political and do not respect any political boundaries.
Knowing that, Kochnev says Russian and American scientists agreed to work together. Our countries collected and shared information on walruses that could shape policy decisions today. All of this when Russia was still ruled by a communist party.
In the Soviet era, financing was provided to the scientists, and that was provided to do the aerial surveys by plane. And the last one of those was in 1990, and that was the last year the Soviet Union funded the surveys.
Since then, Kochnev says Russia has been through some tight economic times, and the funding for projects like this has largely dried up. So I ask, how is he able to spend months at a time in remote parts of Russia studying walruses?
He says that I know myself how he finds money and that I don't need to ask him.
That's Elizabeth Kruger, my Russian translator. She works for the World Wildlife Fund. The organization helps pay for Kochnev's research. Remember Point Lay, the spot where Tony Fishbach observed over 10,000 walruses hauling out? Just across the Bering Strait is Cape Sertsey Common. Kochnev has documented more than 100,000 walruses hauling out there. And over the years, he says he's witnessed the effects of climate change firsthand. Polar bears attacking and killing walruses, something he says biologists hadn't observed at the haul-out before. And just recently, they've seen evidence of walruses eating birds.
That can be an indication that they are finding it more difficult to find food and that their normal food source is not enough. The walruses predating on birds happened 30 years ago, but it is very rare. Now we're starting to see it more often.
Both Kochnev and Fishbach say they hope the haul-out database can help illuminate what's happening to the Pacific walrus. Next year, the feds will decide if the animal should be on the endangered species list. And the database has already received attention from a private company that advises the industry on oil and gas. Fishbach says the database couldn't have happened without decades of scientists working across the Bering Strait.
Even down to the small details, you know, I was having trouble working with the Russian language, representing the Russian script in the database because it's in Cyrillic and I'm using Latin script, and the complexity of that on computer systems is really daunting.
And a Russian scientist who wasn't even working on this project put in the time to lend a hand. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
Alaska Airlines is building a new $40 million maintenance hangar at Ted Stevens Anchorage International Airport. The airline says the project, announced on Friday, will let them service a growing fleet of bigger, more efficient planes. Regional Vice President Marilyn Romano says the new hangar is part of a bigger investment in the state, including terminal updates and new cargo planes, and it coincides with Alaska Airlines' purchase of Virgin America, which is set to vastly expand the company's reach.
It really sets our company up for the future. Whether we're talking about our commitment to the state of Alaska with close to $100 million investment, or it's the acquisition of Virgin America, we've positioned ourselves to be able to grow, and I think that's a really exciting time for our company.
The airline has tapped local architecture firm McCool Carlson Green and general contractor Kiewit to design and build the hangar. Romano says Alaska is still a key market for the company, even as the state struggles financially.
We see that there's a future for business in the state of Alaska, and there's definitely a future for Alaska Airlines in Alaska.
Construction on the new hangar will begin this fall and is expected to be completed in spring of 2018. The search for the abandoned fishing vessel Alaska Juris has been called off. The Unified Command in charge of the search, consisting of the Coast Guard, Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, and the Fishing Company of Alaska, in a press release, say the vessel is presumed sunk in the Bering Sea in 5,400 feet of water. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, seemingly unrelated gun violence in Anchorage over the weekend leaves three dead. That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Apollo MT by Guardian Flight, medevac memberships that protect you or a family member when there is a need for air medical transportation. Information available at apollomt.com.
Three young men were shot and killed in Anchorage over the weekend. A teenager was found shot to death early Sunday on Anchorage's east side. The 17-year-old boy was identified as Zerius Tate. Police took a call after 2 a.m. reporting a disturbance and shots fired. They found the boy dead of gunshot wounds in the area of East 6th Avenue and Newell Street. No one has been arrested. The death is the third fatal Anchorage shooting in 3 days. Just after 3 a.m. on Friday, police found a dead male on a street about 2 blocks north of Muldoon Elementary School. And after 2 a.m. Saturday, police learned 18-year-old Elijah Zeller had been dropped off at a hospital with a gunshot wound. He was pronounced dead at the hospital. For years, the Ninilchik tribe has been seeking, and last week was granted, approval to use a more effective method of catching its subsistence allocation of Kenai River sockeye salmon. The change in gear type has raised concerns about its take of king salmon, a fishery that has been in decline for several years. KBBI's Stacia Eaton has more.
Rather than dip netting, the Ninilchik Traditional Council can now set a gill net. From the Swiftwater launch site in Soldotna, tribal member Daniel Reynolds heads out on the Kenai with two other NTC employees. They're setting out a net that's anchored to a tree on land.
We're on the Kenai River. We're going to go down to Moose Meadows Range and put a 20-foot net out. We'll see how it goes.
Reynolds sets the 5.25-inch mesh net, tossing a metal anchor followed by a 60-pound sandbag into the river. Then extends the net across a section of river, tying the opposite end of the rope to a tree branch on the bank. It's not long before Reynolds walks the net and pulls out a large sockeye and tosses it into a container on the boat. Followed by another and another. The spectacle of a net on the Kenai attracts attention of guides and local fishermen who pull up close to take photos. Some question whether the fishery is legal. Soon, a State of Alaska park ranger, Melissa Smith, pulls up in her boat and wades over to check things out.
How you doing? You guys caught a few today, huh?
She returns with a U.S. Fish and Wildlife law enforcement supervisor who seems to find everything in order. Approval came after a lawsuit filed in 2015. On July 27th, the Federal Subsistence Board approved the tribe's emergency special action request to operate a community subsistence gillnet fishery on the Kenai. NTC is fishing on behalf of the entire community under a federal law passed in 1980 that allows rural residents to participate in subsistence activities on federal lands and waters.
ANILCA was the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, and it did a lot of things, but one of the things it did was establish a federal subsistence system, which gives priority use to rural residents. So it's not a native or a non-native issue, it's a rural community issue.
That's Ivan Enseleski, executive director of NTC.
We're just absolutely elated. You know, it's so many of us have fought for so long. Like I said, this has been going on for over a decade.
There's no shortage of sockeye salmon in the Kenai River. Last year's run of sockeye was 3.6 million, and the upper end of the escapement goal, 1.4 million, was met. But the early king salmon fishery was closed last year due to low returns, and restrictions continued this year. The early run of Kenai River kings this year was nearly 10,000 fish, exceeding the escapement goal. The later run, which the tribe is fishing, is doing better as well, with about 16,500 kings returned as of July 31st, about the halfway point for the upper end of the escapement goal. In 2015, in the Kenai River, sport fishermen took nearly 4,000 late-run king salmon. Commercial fishermen took approximately 7,000, and dipnet personal use, 66 fish. The tribe has allotted 2,000 sockeye and 1,000 kings, and voluntarily agreed to restrict their take of late-run king salmon this season to just 50. As of July 31st, they caught 33 sockeye and no kings. In Nanilchik, the fishermen deliver all 18 of Sunday's catch to community members who signed up to receive them. Jeff and Sandy Olson have lived in Nanilchik for 15 years. The Olsons are not tribal members, but they did apply for a permit to have the tribe fish for them.
My husband had a stroke and I'm legally blind, so I don't get around so much. So it's nice to have the fish.
A single-person household can receive 25 sockeye, with 5 more fish for each additional household member. Sport, commercial, and recreational fishermen are united in their opposition to the tribe setting their gill net for subsistence. Other rural communities allowed to subsistence fish in the Kenai, like Cooper Landing and Hope, oppose subsistence gill netting too. U.S. Fish and Wildlife spokesperson Andrea Medeiros says the agency remains concerned about the impact that Nanilchik's net could have on king salmon.
We do, though, have concerns about that gear type. In that area, it's a spawning ground for early run Chinook. The gill net that they're using, gill nets are non-discriminant, so we feel that there's a risk to not only the Chinook, but other species that may be in that area.
Daryl Williams, Resource and Environment Department Director for the tribe, says the ruling sets strict rules, especially for kings.
There are limits on the fish that we can catch. If we catch Chinook, we take age, sex, and genetic samples and send them in for study to help provide information about the fishery. We haven't caught a Chinook yet.
The special action allows the tribe to operate the subsistence gillnet fishery in the federal waters of the Moose Range Meadows for the next 2 weeks until August 15th. Any future subsistence gillnet fishing will have to be approved. In Homer, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Two boats rescued the passengers of a whale-watching vessel that sank on Sunday. U.S. Coast Guard Petty Officer 3rd Class Lauren Stenson says the tour boat Big Red reported it was taking on water early in the afternoon.
Coast Guard watchstanders issued an urgent marine information broadcast, and there were a couple Good Samaritans that responded.
The CU, the first vessel to reach the Big Red, took most of the 16 passengers and 2 crew members aboard, but it didn't have room for 4 people. Stinson says those 4 waited in the water until Allen Marine Tours vessel, the St. Herman, came on scene.
But once the St. Herman got there, all 18 people were recovered from the water and the other boat and transported to Allen Marine Dock.
The passengers and crew reached shore about 2 hours after they called for help. Capital City Fire and Rescue reported all of the tour boat's passengers and crew refused medical treatment, including one person who had a knee injury. Stenson says the Coast Guard rarely sees vessels sink in the Juneau area, but they do see an increase in calls for vessels taking on water during the summer months.
Especially during those months, we definitely like to stress the importance of having all your safety gear up to date and having a life vest for each person on board and functioning communication equipment.
Lieutenant Jennifer Ferrara, Coast Guard Sector Juneau Command Duty Officer, said in a press release, all of the Big Red's passengers were given life vests. The Big Red was operated by Dolphin Jet Boat Tours. The company didn't respond to requests for comment. The cause of the boat sinking is under investigation. A crew member on a fishing vessel west of Wrangell Island was found dead Saturday morning. Wrangell Search and Rescue responded to the scene after the Coast Guard was notified about 5:47 a.m. on Saturday. Charles Richards of Seattle was a crewman aboard the Odin, when he was found unresponsive in his bunk by a crew member. Richards was taken to the Wrangell Clinic, where he was pronounced dead and was transferred to the state medical examiner's office in Anchorage for autopsy. The cause of death is not known. He was 28 years old. Owner of the Odin, Mark Severson, says his son Cameron recently took over operating the boat.
I just did my stint, and my son had taken over for me, and that was their first outing without me.
Richards, who went by Rhett, went to college with Severson's son.
That's how he came to get on the boat. I needed a guy, and he filled in. He was a great hard worker and a nice, happy-go-lucky kid.
The vessel was southwest of Wrangell in Anita Bay when the call came in.
One of the guys came down when Cameron was starting up the machinery and said that Rhett was not moving, and so they started doing CPR and called the Coast Guard right away.
Severson says Wrangell Search and Rescue arrived about 40 minutes after the call.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline and its operations today and into the future.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
The sockeye salmon run returning to the Stikine River near Petersburg and Wrangell was predicted to be good, but it's turning out to be even better than expected. KFSK's Angela Denning reports.
While the king salmon run for gill netters turned out to be worse than preseason estimates, the opposite holds true for sockeye. The state-managed sockeye fishery began June 13th. Biologists predicted a strong run, but were cautious for the first few weeks to let more king salmon into the Stikine River. They limited openings to 2 days a week and prohibited fishing near the river's opening. After most of the Stikine kings passed, managers saw that the sockeye run was coming in strong.
Sockeye's looking pretty good this year, at least locally.
Troy Tines is the area management biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, based in Petersburg.
We're fairly certain that we're going to exceed preseason expectations, especially with the Taltan River component of the run. That came in really, really strong.
The state predicted a run size of 223,000 sockeye. That's well above the 10-year average of 172,000.
I'm expecting it to be maybe 250,000 or greater.
That would make it the best sockeye return since the strong runs of 2005 and 2006. The Taltan is a tributary of the Stikine River and a major spawning area for sockeye. A weir project at the Taltan Lake counts sockeyes coming in and shows numbers now that are way above average. Managers were expecting at least a good return because of the counting projects at the Taltan Lake. Besides a weir that counts arriving salmon, there is a weir which counts smolt heading out of the lake to become adult fish elsewhere. There is also an enhancement project at the lake, where eggs are collected, grown at a nearby hatchery, and then released back into the lake as fry. Tina says that the Taltan sockeye historically make up close to half of the overall Stikine run.
And based on our catches this year, both Canadian catches in river and our gillnet catches in District 8, it certainly appears that the Taltan component of the run is going to be stronger than what was forecasted.
Because numbers were looking so good this season, managers liberalized commercial openings and allowed for 5 days of fishing per week. There were as many as 130 boats fishing in District 6 and 8, more than in recent years. Their harvests are estimated to be about 120,000 fish. Stikine sockeye are shared equally between the U.S. and Canada because the river runs through both countries. It's part of the Pacific Salmon Treaty. Canada has taken about 69,000 sockeye and U.S. fishermen 66,000.
Very good harvest for both countries.
So you're in constant contact with Canada, mm-hmm. so that everybody's kind of getting about the same amount. That's the goal, 50-50?
The goal is 50-50. I mean, the ultimate goal is to ensure we meat escapement to the river. And then after that, the harvest sharing is 50-50.
The size of the individual sockeye has been about average this year. Gill netters have been getting about $1.35 a pound from local processors. Now that it's the tail end of the sockeye season, local managers will soon be turning their attention to the pink salmon fishery, the largest salmon fishery in Southeast. In Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
An ongoing community archaeology program at the Aleutic Museum and Archaeological Repository in Kodiak yields daily discoveries, and one in particular stood out recently. KMXT's Kayla DeRoche has more.
Aleutic Museum Curator of Archaeology Patrick Saltonstall says they're in the fourth year of digging the Kashavarov site at Saloni Creek and focus on a different spot each time. He says they're about to finish up on the current section, and they've been uncovering many objects.
We're down in the very bottom levels of the site, and all the artifacts we're finding now are like 6,000 to 7,000 years old. And it's been fun. We've been finding like really complete tools. And what's neat is we haven't been finding a lot of the debris that when you make a tool, you have a lot of flakes and bits of slate and stuff. And we haven't been finding any of that. We're just finding the complete tools or the broken tools, because they've been bringing them to the site.
He says they discovered a knife at the location, one of the many pieces of evidence that point to the site having been a hunting camp.
It's kind of unique because it's so big. We find a lot of hunting lances that are shaped the same way from the same time period, but they're about half that size. We've never found anything quite that big. And also it's made out of basalt. It's made out of a rock that's not from Kodiak. Basalt's a volcanic rock, so you only find it on the Alaska Peninsula, so the closest place.
And they've also found the remnants of what may have been a structure.
We can see the post holes, and we can see a lot of gravel and some charcoal. We're sitting around on that surface there. And we actually found that big knife sort of nearby that. It might have been associated with that little sort of structure.
According to the museum website, field and lab work will continue until August 12th. I'm Kayla DeRoche.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Elizabeth Jenkins and Quentin Chandler in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Josh Edge in Anchorage, Dacia Eaton in Homer, Angela Denning in Petersburg, Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak, and Aaron Bolton in Wrangell. Our audio engineer is Ron Zastro, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to slow down and take care with any cleaning, fueling, or painting products while maintaining your boat this summer. Be smart to save money and protect our marine environment and our beautiful ocean and coastline. Let's keep the water clean and keep our fish healthy. For more information, go to alaskacleanharbors.org. This message is sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program. Boating accidents happen even to experienced boaters and even on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make your friends and loved ones promise to always wear a life jacket and carry emergency communication and distress signaling devices. Visit pledgetolive.org, where you can file a float plan, get marine weather forecasts, and download a pre-departure checklist. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.